WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work offers a one-year advanced standing option for students with a bachelor's degree in social work that builds on prior training and connects students with expert faculty and 5 specialized pathways. Apply by February 1st at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Many of us have been here before. Your doctor tells you that you need to get a certain procedure or a test done. Maybe you need a certain medication, and you need it ASAP. Well, it might not happen as soon as you might hope. That's because physicians can need approval from your insurer before they can schedule or prescribe you anything. This is called prior authorization. And while it sounds like something harmless, it actually leaves many people waiting in limbo before they can get the care that they need. And sometimes people don't have the time to wait. From health professionals to patients to Governor J.B. Pritzker, there's a growing push to remove the barriers to care that prior authorization creates. In a few minutes, we'll hear from one Illinoisan struggling with prior authorization to manage her father's chemo treatment. But first, we'll hear from Zarek Brott-Goldberg, assistant professor at the UChicago Harris School of Public Policy. He starts by explaining how prior authorization works.
Generally, you might think of there as being two extremes, right? There's some things that the health insurance company will cover, they'll pay for. There's some things that they will refuse to cover. You might think about cosmetic surgery, for instance, right? Health insurers won't pay for that. And then you can think of prior authorization as something in the middle, right? So the insurer says, we'll cover this sometimes, but in order for you to receive coverage, we need to explicitly authorize that coverage. So what that means is your doctor will have to file a request on your behalf, and if the insurer approves that request, then you'll receive coverage. Right. Otherwise, you pay out of pocket.
Why do insurance companies need to do this?
So you can think of this as sort of a one tool in what's called utilization management, right? The idea is, you know, we know in healthcare is full of problems. If there wasn't, I'd have nothing to talk about. One of the problems that there's a bunch of procedures which are very high price and oftentimes we might think are overused. And insurers, in some sense, are stewards of keeping costs down. So if costs go up, they have to push that into premiums, and that raises the cost for your employer or for taxpayers. And so to the extent that they're stewards for costs, they might want to limit the use of medications or of services that are high cost and relatively low value.
I see.
And so this is one tool to sort of restrict the use of these potentially high cost, low value medications and services.
Are there any benefits to prior authorization?
Again, I think you should think of the benefit, the primary benefit, social benefit, as cost saving. So, you know, one example is there's something my former mentor Amitabh Chandra calls the Death Star of American medicine, which is proton beam therapy.
Okay.
So it's a very expensive treatment for cancer. Basically, they turn on a high powered machine and shoot proton beams and try to eliminate the cancer with that. These machines are incredibly expensive. They cost over $100 million to buy. Turning them on, Medicare is going to pay maybe $50,000. And the effectiveness, certainly the cost effectiveness, is not clear. And so you might want to think about restricting, you know, who gets to use these incredibly expensive services and making sure it's used by people who are really the most needy.
Yeah.
It's sometimes a little vulgar to say we're going to decide how much we pay to keep people healthy. And I agree. It's a little, it sounds bad when it comes out of my mouth. But in the end, you know, this is one of the ways in which we think about, well, we want to spend a lot of money to help people stay healthy. We want to be careful about, you know, not blowing the bank on on doing so.
I want to bring another voice into the conversation. We're joined now by Jackie Covarrubias, who's a resident of Countryside, Illinois. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You were listening to a recent conversation on Reset, and you left us a voice message, Jackie, and it was about prior authorization, right? An issue there. You were talking about problems with your father's chemo medication. So I want you to tell us, in your own words, what's been happening and how long it's been going on.
In 2016, my mother was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. 2017, my dad got diagnosed with leukemia. 2018, 1 year later, my mom passed away. So, and my dad still has leukemia. Since then, it's been on and off on, you know, it's been in limbo on getting accepted for chemo. Mm-hmm. And so, they give us curveballs. Like, my dad will call me frustrated. Jackie, I need you to call so-and-so. I can't take it anymore. They're declining my chemo medicine.
And you're talking about pills.
Pills,
right?
Yeah. So my dad has to take chemo and a pill, which without insurance costs about $4,000 a month.
Okay.
And so he has to work in order to keep insurance to pay for this pill, no matter how nauseous it can make them. So it's very frustrating to just not know when you're going to get declined for medication because they don't let us know ahead of time.
Yeah. And so what are you hearing? What is the insurance company saying each time the medication is denied? Like, what is the reason?
Well, sometimes they say it's, you know, they need to get authorization from the doctor, but my dad would walk out of the doctor's office, get his medication prescribed. Nothing changes. It's the same chemo, same dose every time. And then they'll just decline him. So it's always a surprise to us when they do it, how they do it. And it seems a little bit like everybody's pointing the finger and not everybody on the medical team is on the same page.
So like doctors would say, contact the insurance company.
Contact the insurance company.
The insurance company saying,
contact the doctor. And then they're like, contact the medical team would say, contact the pharmacy. And it's just like a triangle that is just very frustrating.
Professor Brock Goldberg, this is not uncommon, right?
No, there's plenty of stories like Jackie's in terms of people who've waited very long times for determinations or who feel like they don't understand the reason for their determination. They end up in a ping pong back and forth between themselves and the insurers and their doctors and their pharmacies.
So what options do people really have?
I mean, sometimes the option is to try to pay large sums of money out of pocket, right? If you don't request insurance coverage, then you can get the drug. It's just you're paying a lot of money.
Jackie, is that an option for your father?
You know, it is an option, but my dad can't pay out of pocket. And then also, too, the pharmacy will switch to a generic chemo pill that my dad is unfamiliar with. And so my dad will say, why am I given the choice to take a different type of chemo medication when it was never explained by my oncologist? So now they're changing my medication treatment. It's just very confusing.
And as you mentioned before, I mean, regardless of the impact of the medication on your father, he has to continue working. He has to maintain that job.
Yes.
To keep that insurance.
Yes.
To hopefully pay for this medication.
Yes. Because he's too young to retire and get any extra help.
WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
Professor, are there folks who are more at risk of having challenges with prior authorization than others?
You know, I would say
maybe certain illnesses or...
So the funny part is we know very little about the rates of denial in prior authorization. So one purpose of some of the regulation that's happened in the last couple of years is to try to make that a little bit more clear. So in my own work on prior authorization, for instance, we don't really know the denial rates. So we can see, for example, who gets medication, but we can't see this back and forth between the patient and the doctor.
Yeah.
So there's surprisingly little information about the rates of denial, the numbers of requests, things like that.
You know, as you talk, Jackie, about folks pointing fingers back and forth, I mean, are you hearing frustration from the doctors?
Yes.
On this?
Yes.
What are they saying?
All the time. They really don't know why they need pre-authorization. Sometimes it's they don't have any answers. They'll say, okay, we'll get on it. Let me call, you know, the oncologist and see what we can do. And it might be a few days. It might be a week. Yeah, they might say, you know, the insurance companies maybe don't listen to us but so maybe we can call them, and it would be best if you call them too, and we can team up on that if you want faster results.
Really?
But then again, sometimes it's like, who has the time to call? And so my father, you know, he works sometimes, you know, 9 to 5 or like a 12-hour shift or something, and he doesn't have time to call on a lunch break that's 15 to 30 minutes long, or be home early enough to make a phone call and call them during office hours.
So that's when he has you step in.
Exactly.
He loops you into the process.
Exactly.
To make some of those phone calls for him.
Exactly. And so when my mom was alive, I was doing it twice for two people.
Wow.
Yeah.
You dealt with it with your mother as well.
Yes, yes, yes.
Wow, I'm so sorry to hear, Jackie.
Thank you.
Is there anything, Professor, that can be done on the doctor's end to make the process less confusing and stressful for people?
You mean in terms of regulation, in terms of what doctors themselves can do?
Both.
You know, I think, like I said, there's been a lot of push lately to, in regulatory terms, to think about both making the reasons for denials much more clear, mandating sort of an explicit categorization of reasons for denials.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's something that I think would be very important. I think in some sense, it would be helpful if doctors explained at least the insurer's motivations in doing this. Things like substitution to generics, those are sometimes things where two drugs where one is a branded, one is generic, and the generic is much cheaper and roughly the exact same. And so pharmacies will often substitute from the branded to the generic if it's what's called a bioequivalent drug.
Right.
That can be very surprising if you're a patient who, you know, doesn't know these rules. You show up at the pharmacy, you hear that something's getting switched around.
You would wonder, what is this?
Yeah, what is this?
Yeah.
Is my body going to respond in the same way?
Right.
And it would help, you know, for things like that, it would help if you know, doctors have a role in educating patients. Mm-hmm. For things like prior authorization denials, you know, again, sometimes the doctor doesn't totally know what's going on the insurer side. And indeed, we see a lot of cases like Jackie's where the doctor tells the patient, oh, maybe you should go agitate the insurer, and the insurer will feel much more compelled to act when you're calling as opposed to when I'm calling. I think a lot of the point of prior auth is to get doctors to justify the things they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not great when doctors are shifting this justification burden onto vulnerable patients like Jackie's father.
And on top of everything, Jackie, language was also a barrier at times, right?
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
My father speaks English, but getting through, sometimes you feel more comfortable speaking in Spanish. And so oftentimes if they do have, right now everybody's short-staffed and, you know, there's longer waits, more frustration.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, with the Spanish community, I know many people that are just frustrated and don't go to the doctor at all. One of my best friend's dad has never gone to the doctor ever because there's just a disconnect with and mistrust. Like they're like, oh, they're just going to diagnose me with something and it's all about the money.
Some kind of medication that I don't understand.
Yeah. Yeah. So it can be challenging. You know, I think about patients that don't have a relative or a friend that can translate for them. And there's translating services, but they're not as good at the hospitals. Or they can be short staffed. They don't have volunteers.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a complicated process. I mean, I know that you've done some research on this, Professor. Anything else that you've learned when it comes to prior auth?
The way I think about it is prior auth is a really powerful tool. I mean, it does a lot to move patients off of the drugs we put restrictions on. So in my own work, for example, we look at prescription drugs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, facing a prior authorization restriction on a prescription drug reduces the share of patients who take that drug by about 25%.
Really?
And, you know, some of them get diverted to nothing, right? They you know, you put a prior authorization on drug A, it might be that we were intending to try to get the patient to move to drug B, try to get some patients to at least try, say, a cheaper option before they move to a more expensive drug A. But a decent amount of patients move to getting no care at all, which is a real problem.
And now Governor Pritzker wants to ban prior authorization for mental health care in Illinois. That's where he wants to at least start.
Yeah.
What do you think of that as a solution?
So it's funny that there's been, I think in his State of State address, he really declared he wants to really, I think, do more on prior authorization.
Yes.
What he proposed is specifically, I think, for inpatient mental health care, inpatient hospital mental health care.
For adults and children.
For adults and children. My guess is, given how recent Illinois legislation has shook out, that'll probably be primarily for Medicaid. For example, Illinois has both passed one bill and posed a couple other bills regulating prior authorization. It's really only applied to Medicaid, not to, I think Jackie said that her father's still working. He might receive health insurance through his employer.
Yeah.
If so, this legislation would not affect him at all.
Would not affect
him. I haven't done any work on mental health inpatient use, so it's hard for me to say, you know, how much overuse of this stuff is there. There's been some other bills to try to restrict it for drugs for mental health care mm-hmm. use. There's a recent bill that was proposed last month trying to ban virtually all prior authorization for anyone on Medicaid or in a state health insurance
plan. But I wonder if this could be looked upon as maybe a first step, right? We start with mental health care and perhaps we'll broaden the spectrum a little bit.
I mean, the question is, you know, is a ban necessarily what Illinois wants to do? Again, there's a spectrum of things you could do, right?
Yeah.
You could constrain insurers and how quickly they have to respond or how much information they have to provide. Or you could ban this tool completely.
Right.
I have to say I'm a little negative about trying to ban these tools completely. If you try to ban these tools to lower costs, what we've seen insurers do is instead just try to shift costs onto patients. So using things like high deductible plans. And so oftentimes, if the strategy to reining in costs in this way doesn't work, we're going to try something else. And it's not clear that that's going to be a happier result. Yeah.
Well, we're just about out of time, Jackie, but I would love for you to just share with the folks listening now just what you've learned through this experience.
You have to be your best health advocate for yourself. The best thing I've learned so far is looking up questions. Know that you don't know everything.
Right.
Look up questions online. What questions should I ask my doctor? Know your insurance plan. Have a journal with you. Write a T-chart. Questions on the left. Room for answers on the right. And also, if you are talking to your insurance company, be in the right place of mind.
Yeah.
And you know, I know it's frustrating, but, you know, just taking a few deep breaths and just, you know, just not scream or yell, but just really just talk to them. Everybody's human and we're all trying to find answers. But the best thing is writing your journal and your questions. Yeah. Ask for resources.
That's Jackie Covarrubias, Reset listener from Countryside, Illinois, and UChicago Harris of Public Policy Assistant Professor Zarek Brodt-Goldberg. Thank you both.
Thank you.
This episode of the Reset podcast was produced by Micah Yasin, edited by Meha Ahmed, and mixed by Brenda Ruiz. And this conversation came from a listener suggestion. So if there's a health topic that you would like us to cover here on Reset, just email us at reset@wbez.org. You can also leave us a voicemail at 888-915-9945. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Let's talk again soon.
My name is Donald. I live on the southeast side of Chicago. I support WBEZ because of the balanced reporting and covering so much about an issue as opposed to just the few seconds that you may hear on most other news outlets. It matters to me to hear the story more completely.